But I'm so glad that you're here in person. So thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so this could be looked at as part one or as part three, because it is an extension of the discussion that we had in June about when Mashiach, the Messiah, will come. In series, we talked about the origin of the idea of the Messiah in Judaism. We traced it through Tanakh. We talked about whether it's the no, because people are coming in. We talked about whether it is a person who is a Mashiach. Is it an era? And we showed that the sources really do speak about a particular person who seems to be a human being, although we're going to actually come back to that now, who is the king. He's supposed to be the leader of the Jewish people, who guides them in a path of Torah. And yes, it does usher in an era that seems to have some supernatural predictions, although it's not entirely clear that those predictions are meant literally, number one. And number two, it's not entirely clear that that's for the period of the Messiah or for some period after that. The period of perhaps Triat HaMeitim, the resurrection of the dead. We gave that whole thing sort of short shrift. We talked about it, but there's a lot more to say, and some of it we're going to come back to today. We also talked about whether you're allowed to ask when will the Messiah come. Is that an okay question for a Jew to ask? And we showed sources that say we're not supposed to investigate when the Messiah will come, because, first of all, these predictions are useless information. Perhaps there is no set time at all. It's about when we're supposed to have it happen. We could earn it early, or there's a deadline by which it has to come. We said bad predictions are bad for us. What happens when people get it wrong? Our history of false messiahs. The fact that it causes people to stop believing. We even saw the idea that it's built into the Messiah that it's supposed to come when you're not paying attention, when you're not looking for it. It's counterproductive to try to calculate the time. Nonetheless, we said, number one, it's valuable to learn the predictions of when the Messiah will come, first of all, because it's Torah and we learn it, and second, because it can help people with their faith in it to know that there are Jewish sources that actually do predict and say, no, this is what you're going to see. This is what's going to happen. And so we went into four different types of predictions. One, predictions of activities that will bring the Messiah. So we had specific things like tzedakah, the end of bad judges and bad leaders, observing two Sabbaths, if the Jews will observe two Sabbaths. We talked about the generation that is all good or all bad. I want to come back to that today. Then the second type were predictions based on events that are not necessarily of our doing, but events that will happen. So, for example, when the land of Israel bears fruit, and we're going to talk about that one. I want to come back to that. The end of the using up of all of the souls, when all the souls God intended to have in this world have cycled through, was another one. We had a third type of predictions that are tied to particular calendar dates. So we had the idea that the Messiah will come in the month of Nisan or the month of Tishrei. We talked about that at a certain point within the 7-year sabbatical cycle, which is one that I also want to come back to. And then we had actual dates, particularly from the book of Daniel. We saw predictions of after this number of weeks, after this number of years, and the problem is only figuring out what that means. And the Talmud gave us dates. 400 years after the destruction of the temple was one prediction. Another one was the year 4291, which is the year 531 of the Common Era, 4291 from creation. We had the prediction that Messiah will come by the year 6000. And then we concluded with a little bit of a discussion of why the idea of the Messiah is so important within Judaism, right? But this basically captures what we did, no? I think, okay, that's just very fast recap of where we were with it. And now, so what I want to do, as I said at the end of the first 2-week mini-series, is I want to go into some of these sources in greater depth. Are you sure you don't want a table? I feel like it would be useful.
I'm just going to get up and give you a table.
I think we're just going to pause for a second and just get out another table. It's worthwhile.
It's a little funny. Thank you. That was very funny.
Thank you.
Stephen has another one. Okay, we're back. We are back. So let's see. So the first thing that I wanted to do, yeah, the recorder's still going. Yeah, yeah. No, they just went and got coffee while we were getting tables. So revisiting some of our sources on the identity of the Messiah. We talked about very, very briefly the idea that there actually isn't only Messiah, son of David, but descendant of the Davidic dynasty, but there is also Messiah, son of Joseph. Now, let's be really clear. The fact that the Christians have some idea of, Joseph as the father, or not the father, as the case may be, if it's linked to this, it's because they had access to our sources, and therefore they, said what they said. One should not, make the mistake of thinking this is somehow an endorsement of their theology. The concept of it is seen, yeah, Paul.
Does that not undermine their whole concept of him being divine? Because if it's son of Joseph, then God was not the father.
Yes. Yes, that's what I meant when I said, is the father or is not the father, as the case may be. I don't know how they reconcile the idea that the Messiah is a human being, according to our sources, although we will see in a little bit some Jewish sources that require some clarification on that front. But I don't know how they, how they deal with that. I'm certain they have, something to reconcile it within their ideology. Most of our sources are pretty clear that it's a human being, born of human beings.
Does David come from Joseph?
No. Two entirely different lines until you get back to Jacob, meaning the son of David means son of descendant of King David, who is from the tribe of Judah.
Okay.
Son of Joseph means descendant of the tribe of Joseph. So they merge when you get back to
two tribes of
Jacob.
Joseph.
So Joseph has two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, but it means descendant of Joseph.
Right.
Yeah. If you take a look at source number one, this is a source which I mentioned in the earlier series, and this will kick off our discussion of the Messiah, son of Joseph. There is a eulogy that is described in the book of Zechariah, and we're going to see it. It'll be in source number 8. But the section in Zechariah that it's coming from, the last three chapters of the book of Zechariah, speak about a war on a Jerusalem that happens at the end of days. Just a little bit more background. Zechariah is a prophet towards the beginning of the Second Temple period. You're talking about somewhere around the 5th century before the Common Era. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi are the three books of prophecy that we have that date to that era. They are, if you were to open a Tanakh, you would be opening to the end of the section called the prophets, the Nevi'im. There's an area called Trei Asar, which is a collection of 12 small books of prophecy. Some of those that are more familiar, the book of Jonah is in there. That's somewhat well known. So Zechariah has a lot of great visions. And like I said, his last three chapters are the visions of this war on Jerusalem, which we're going to talk about. But he talks about there being a eulogy, and the Talmud says, what is the nature of this eulogy? Rabbi Dosa and the sages disagreed. One said it's a eulogy for the Messiah, the son of Joseph, who has been executed. The other said it's for the Yetzer Hara, which has been executed. And that takes the discussion in a completely different direction, to talk about the idea that in the future, at this messianic age, there is no longer a desire to do evil. There's no, according to this idea, according to this source, there is no Yetzer Hara, there is no evil inclination, so to speak. And then the question is, well, why would you eulogize it? Right? Who's grieving? And the answer that's given in the Talmud is a beautiful answer, which takes us in a little bit of another direction, but I think it's an okay digression. Have you ever noticed that some of the people who have committed like terrible deeds have also done wonderful things? You don't always, you know, sometimes you see people who are just completely corrupt and rotten and so on. But you see sometimes that there are people who have done amazing, wonderful things, and they also do terrible things. They also fall into disaster. So I was thinking about giving examples, but I'm worried about giving an example because I don't want to start naming names. So I'll mention a person without mentioning his name, and some of you are familiar. There is, in Israel, an organization which does incredible work after terror attacks. In terms of taking care of victims, in terms of showing respect to the bodies and so on. And there was it. Come on in. We saved you a seat right here. And the founder of the organization was found to be, you want to give him a sheet? The founder of the organization turns out, I don't know all the specifics because honestly I didn't want to read a whole lot about it, but turns out to have assaulted a woman.
Have what?
Assaulted a woman. And the charge is a credible charge, and there may be more than one. There often is when you're dealing with stuff like this. And on the one hand, you know, this, you know, selfless founding of an organization that does incredible things, and on the other hand, like a horrible beast of a person. So there are two schools of thought.
There's also someone.
Oh, I don't want more.
I'm not going to give names.
Unfortunately, the trail of people like this is not short. No. Unfortunately, we've seen it.
There's a problem. Excuse me, but when one is aware that somebody has done something, probably done something wrong, and at the same time has done something good. My son-in-law is involved in something like that. He received a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a talk between other people who listen to him.
Yeah.
But whether they should give it.
No, what Ricky is talking about is the fact that you find there are scholarships, there are university institutions and so on that are dedicated by people who got their money in inappropriate ways. Yeah.
Well, isn't there also a concept that without the Yetzer Hara, a lot of good things would not be done? Is that... that impulse that also brings us to build up. And
right. So that was where I was going with this. There are two schools... There are two schools of thought in the Talmud about how you get people like this. One school of thought says that... and this is the passage here in the Talmud that they're talking about, that the Yetzer Hara competes with a person. And it's like a muscle. The more you do that is good, the more you keep yourself from doing that which is bad, the stronger the Yetzer Hara becomes. And so what they describe here is people's tears at the death of this Yetzer Hara is either because they look at it and it was like a hair and they say, I could have snapped it at any time because I never fought it. Or it's like a mountain for them because they did fight it and they're like, how in the world did I manage this all this time? So according to this school of thought, the people who do great things end up combating a stronger and stronger Yetzer Hara, and ultimately they can end up giving in. There's a passage elsewhere in the Talmud where they speak about one of the sages who was walking on the road, and he saw a man and woman in front of him, and somehow, I don't know how, he knew they weren't married to each other. And he says, I'm going to walk behind them because I anticipate this is a secluded area, something bad is going to happen, and I'll be able to prevent it. And he walks behind them, and nothing happens. They part ways. He goes his way. She goes her way. And he's very depressed. He goes to the study hall and he says, you know, if I were this guy, you know, I totally would have fallen into this. I would have done something I shouldn't do, he says. And is it that I'm a terrible person and I can't, you know, this guy here who's walking on the road had no problem, but I'm a terrible person? And they comforted him by saying, no, because you have been, you know, working so well. You can read their comfort in two different ways also, but the way I'm reading it right now is they say to him, because you have worked so hard, because you have built yourself up like this, therefore you're also dealing with a higher temptation than this person is. That was their consolation for him. But that's one school of thought. The other school of thought, and this goes back to what Janine was saying, is it's not that there's an evil inclination and a good inclination. There's an inclination. And some people have more of a drive for certain things, and some people have less of a drive for certain things. But those things they're pursuing can be used in a good way or used in a bad way. So the story in the Talmud that Janine is referencing talks about a time when the sages prayed to God, eliminate the desire for sexual immorality. Just get rid of it. And God says, sure. And God gets rid of it. 3 days later, there are no eggs. They're looking for eggs, and there are no eggs. Because the idea is, I leave aside that chickens lay unfertilized eggs. That's not the point of the story. The point of the story is that you have a drive for something, and it can be a powerful drive that can be used in a good way, and it can be used in a bad way. And you actually see this very often when you have people of great charisma who, you know, attract people and lead people, but they end up, they can lead people in a good direction, they can lead people in a bad direction, and they could use it in both directions. And that happens. So that's a second school of thought. One school of thought is, these are people who just pass the test a lot, and then they fail because the test gets too hard. The other school of thought is that these are people with great potentials, but the potential can be good and the potential can be bad. You have some people who are not overachievers. They'll do what they do and the world will never know and they'll never be in the headlines. That's not their thing. And you have other people who are overachievers but can be overachievers for good and can be overachievers for bad. That's all tangent. So you didn't miss anything. But in terms of the discussion at hand, the first view in source number one, that it's the Messiah son of Joseph who has been executed, what in the world are you talking about? So here's the concept. We know the story of the 10 lost tribes. King David is king over a united kingdom. You have 12 tribes living in the land of Israel. The tribe of Judah is in the south. There are some cities that are owned by the tribe of Shimon, of Simon, that are also found there. The tribe of Benjamin is just north of Judah. And then all the other tribes are around north of that or east of the Jordan River. That's the basic layout. David is succeeded by his son Solomon, who is king for 40 years. At the end of Solomon's time, he starts to deteriorate. There's a whole story behind that. That's not for right now. Those were my Tuesday afternoon class. We spent the year talking about it. But at the end of his life, he deteriorates in terms of his righteousness to the point where God says, I'm going to rip away most of the kingdom from your descendant. Not from you, but from your descendant. Your son is going to lose most of the kingdom. Sure enough, there is a man who was a member of the hierarchy of Solomon's workforce. His name is Yeravam. Yeravam becomes angry because of one of the things that Solomon does, not going into it right now. But after Solomon is gone, he leads a revolt. Solomon's son, Rehoboam, is, among other things, not very wise about how he taxes the people. And Yeravam, I know it's confusing, Yeravam, Rehoboam, they rhyme, but Yeravam leads a revolt of the 10 northern tribes. Simon, their cities are gone from Judah. It's basically Judah and Benjamin together and everybody else. So Yeravam leads the everybody else, the 10 tribes. Now, they don't go anywhere. They're living in northern Israel. That's where they are. However, they identify as a different kingdom. Their kingdom is called Yisrael, Israel. The southern kingdom is called Judah, right? Like the tribe that makes up the bulk of the space. The northern kingdom descends into idolatry fairly quickly. And it's pretty much a non-stop disaster story, the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom has its ups and downs. Some of the kings are better, some of the kings are worse. If you think of the righteous kings you've heard of, they tend to be in the south. Chizkiyahu, Hezekiah, Yoshiyahu, Josiah, like kings like that, they're in the south. The northern kingdom's best example is King Ahab, His wife is Jezebel. You may have heard of her. So that's the northern kingdom. And when they deteriorate, the Assyrians invade. Assyrians, not to be confused with Syrians, two different populations. The Assyrians invade, and their method of conquest is to transplant populations. They conquer an area, they move you out, and they move somebody else in, right? Why do you do that? What's the advantage? Well, I mean, you can call it ethnic cleansing, but what's it really about?
Yeah. Well, you take away their strength.
You take away their strength, right. They're no longer rooted in the area. You fight differently when you're fighting for your own land. Plus, you know it. It's your turf. You have your family history there. You have connections. When you exile people, they have to start from scratch with everything. So it was an effective method of conquest, and they didn't just do it to us. Sorry?
Sorry, I said it is, because it's still happening.
True. They even though I think it's one of those things that the Geneva Convention bans. I read the headlines. I even read the articles sometimes. I'm in that in between age where I read them sometimes. Yeah, Professor.
At some point, I'd like you to address the question of if any commentary on why we were tribes and we established our state in tribes.
Yes. Yes, so I gave a class on this some years back because it's a fascinating point. The fact that on the one hand we celebrate the unity of the Jewish people and it is so important to us, and on the other hand tribal identity is retained. There's even a midrash building on verses in Isaiah which says that when the Jews cross the sea, getting out of Egypt, right, escaping from the Egyptians, the sea is split into different channels, one for each tribe. And you look at it and say, what, even then? even then we needed to be different? And to make a long story short, I floated the idea that there are three benefits to retaining tribal identity. One of them is each tribe is unique. It has its own talents that it's known for. And so there is value in saying, I value that which makes them special. This tribe does these things. They have a certain element of expertise and identity. That was one of my explanations. I'm forgetting what my second explanation was, but I must not have liked it much. The third idea, though, is that there is security for people when their identity is respected, and it gives them the ability to blend with others more. Paradoxically, people are more likely to blend when they feel like their identity is secure and not under threat. And that's something that sociologists have noted. I didn't invent the idea.
That's why we still accept the Ashkenazians.
There's a lot in terms of why people do it. There's a lot in terms of why people like to retain that. But I think that it's certainly true that people are more apt to stick to tradition the more personal it is for them. If I feel like this relates to where I came from, to my roots, I will feel a stronger connection to it. And I'm more apt to continue it. Some of you may be in the Agnon group. So I'm giving a class on Monday evening. Shai Agnon, I taught a story of his in a mini-series earlier this year. The Nobel Prize winning Israeli author. So he has a story which I'm going to be teaching on Monday evening. That'll be on Zoom, unfortunately. But it's called Veloni Kashel, and We Shall Not Stumble. And in it, he talks about the importance of, he's talking about liturgy, retaining the liturgy of one's ancestors, the way that they prayed specifically, and how important it is for the family line. I'm not going to go into the story now, because I do want to get towards this topic at some point. But there's a lot to be said for retaining it, even though it absolutely enhances division when we aren't just saying, look, we're all one family. We're saying, well, yeah, we're a family, but we have our sub-family. The Jews who came over to North America and formed this is the Russian minion, and this is the Polish minion, and this is the Hungarian minion, the stories aren't great stories about some of those.
Just the other side of the coin is the diverse approaches also gives an individual a chance to approach Judaism in a different way, which is more consonant with the way he feels.
Can be.
You know, you from tribes you go into Hasidism or all sorts of different groups, and you may find your place in another place, which is still valid.
Right, but if you're gonna enforce tribal lines, then they're not allowed to jump.
Right.
You know, they're stuck in it. There's a difference between diversity and saying you have to be diverse in this way. I think that's where we get into trouble sometimes.
There's also diversity within a diversity, because you have people from the same city who are more special than others.
Oh, yes.
There are certain Jews, the Yekes, were considered
right.
to be...
Sociologists like to talk about that, about how we subdivide, and you, when a group reaches a certain size, so now you need to find your group within that. That's now, this is my group. We did that. We had a class about Jewish sociology years ago, but I'm going to go back to this because I actually didn't get to the point yet. So the Assyrians invade and they exile the northern tribes. I gave you some verses from Kings 2, chapter 2. I'm sorry, source number 2. Kings 2, chapter 17, where I listed for you, I listed the text lists for you, the ninth year of the king Hoshea. He's the king of the northern kingdom. The Assyrians exile the Jews to all sorts of lands. Now, the truth is, we have texts that seem to speak of the Jews coming back from those lands already towards the end of the First Temple period. The Talmud says it in source number 3, that Jeremiah brought them back, and King Josiah was king over them, and they offer you a verse from Yechezkel, from Ezekiel, to support it. In source number 4, I brought you verses from Isaiah, which speak of God bringing back the scattered Israelites, which seems to be referring to not a later time, but actually even possibly in the First Temple. Nonetheless, the idea of a Messiah son of Joseph, or Mashiach ben Yosef, as he'll be called in Hebrew, is in this future messianic time, these 10 tribes are going to rejoin us, and their king is the Messiah, son of Joseph. Because Joseph is the leader of those tribes. Those tribes are often called in Tanakh Ephraim, who is one of Joseph's sons. So their king is the Messiah, son of Joseph. If you take a look at source number 5, Rabbi Avram ibn Ezra, writing in the 11th century, says, commenting on Zechariah, in chapter 12 in Zechariah, where it speaks of a leader coming back, this portion continues from before, where it said, his sword upon his arm, telling when this would happen, this final battle in Jerusalem, and where. Now it explains this will be when Yisrael returns to Jerusalem with Mashiach ben Yosef. This prophecy is about Yisrael, about the northern kingdom. So he says, Mashiach ben Yosef is the king of the northern tribes. That's who it is. Yes, Ricky.
I was going to say, but Benjamin is Yosef's brother.
Correct.
That's not that.
That's correct. Benjamin stays loyal to Judah. That is true. Now, it's interesting because... Yeah,
so
Janine.
Is Ibn Ezra talking about what happened historically or the future?
So Ibn Ezra is talking about what will happen in the future. The vision of Zechariah unquestionably is a future vision, because Zechariah is Second Temple. He can't be talking about something that has already happened. He's talking future, and we haven't seen it happen yet. Even though there are all these legends about, lost tribes coming back, you know, whether the Ethiopians, we talked about this, we had a class at Beth Emeth a few years ago where we talked about the Ethiopians and those who wanted to suggest that they were from one of the lost tribes. It was when we did our seven-part series celebrating 70 for the seven decades of the State of Israel. So one of them was about the return of the Ethiopians.
And the Menashe people in India.
Right, the group in India that are identified as B'nai Menashe, what exactly that means. So, you know, this is a little bit of a challenge, though, saying he's going to be the king from those tribes, because we have a verse in Genesis which says that the scepter shall never leave Judah. Judah is supposed to be the royal tribe. But don't get hung up on that, because the first king we had was King Saul, and King Saul was from Benjamin. And the commentators deal with it, and they have different explanations, and you don't need to get hung up on that, and I'm not going to take our time with it right now. There are predictions in Tanakh, or passages in Tanakh, which seem to predict Messiah, son of Joseph. Example, when we first settled the land, when we came in under Joshua, there was a first round of tribal assignments recorded in Joshua chapters 15 to 17, and then there was a second round in chapters 18 and 19. The first round went to Judah, Menashe, and Ephraim. Menashe and Ephraim are the sons of Joseph. Why does it go to those in the first batch, as opposed to Naphtali, Zebulun, Gad, Asher? All of these other tribes have to wait for the second round. Why are these getting it first? Take a look at source number 6. Rabbi Meir Leibush Weiser, also known as Malbim, comments to Joshua, saying that the first round went to Judah and Joseph because the shoot of monarchy would grow from them. And so the two anointed ones received their portion first, meaning Messiah from the tribe of Judah, that's Messiah son of David, and Messiah son of Joseph. Those are the ones who are the anointed ones. The rest of the tribes did not receive their portions in that first lot. They had to wait for the second round. Similarly, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer in source number 7, also known as the Vilna Gaon, says Judah and Ephraim are the heads of the tribes everywhere, in the order of the flags that the Jews camped and marched with when they were in the wilderness. The first kings came from them, and therefore in the future, he says, may it come speedily, Mashiach, son of David, Mashiach, son of Joseph, will be the redeemers and the leaders. And the Jewish nation is Judah in the south and Ephraim in the north, and therefore they also took first in the division of the land. So we're analyzing division of the land on the basis of what's going to be in the future. There are various verses we can bring to support this. The prophet Micha has it. But the clearest reference, without doubt, is the passage in Zechariah, when he envisions the reunion of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom in this war of the nations. And I brought you source number 8, Zechariah chapter 12. Behold, he predicts, I will make Jerusalem a cup of poison for all the surrounding nations, meaning the ones who are going to attack and invade. And also upon Judah will be in siege upon Jerusalem. This passage is a little bit difficult to explain, but basically it seems that he's predicting that Judah is going to attack Jerusalem also in those days, even though Jerusalem is in Judah, but the Jews who live outside will attack. Unclear whether that's willing or because they're forced to by the nations around them, but that's part of the prediction. And on that day, God will guard the dwellers of Jerusalem. The stumbling among them, the weakest among them, will be like David, mighty warrior. David will be like a divine being, like an angel of God before them. Their strong ones are going to be very powerful. So even though Jerusalem is under attack, Jerusalem will be able to defend itself. And on that day, I will seek to destroy all the nations who attack Jerusalem. I will pour out upon the house of David and the dwellers of Jerusalem a spirit of favor and supplication. They will look to me regarding the one who has been stabbed. And that's the reference to their leader who has been killed, Messiah, son of Joseph. They will eulogize him like a eulogy for an only child. They will be bitter about him, meaning about his death, like the bitterness for a firstborn. On that day, the eulogy in Jerusalem will be great, like the eulogy of Hadad Rimon in the valley of Megiddo. That's a reference which we're not going to explore right now. The land will eulogize each family separately, the family of the house of David separately and their wives separately, the family of the house of Nathan separately and their wives separately, the family of Levi separately, their wives separately, each one, the men and the women separately. This is actually brought in the Talmud at the end of Sukkah. That's the passage that we read in source number one for a reason which could lead to an entire miniseries in its own right. So I'm taking the risk of explaining it because it's interesting. But I'm telling you right now, I'm not going there. Okay? The passage at the end of Sukkah speaks about something called Simchas Beis HaShoeva. Anybody know what that is? Anybody ever hear of it? On Sukkot. Normally, temple sacrifices are either animal or grain, and you bring wine and oil and pour it on the altar. Once a year, on the holiday of Sukkot, they pour water on the altar. It wasn't one day, it's multiple days, but it's one occasion, the holiday of Sukkot, they pour water on the altar. The reason being, because that's the beginning of the rainy season in Israel, and it's a prayer for rain. So you're bringing your water to God as an offering and beseeching God for water. But it was a massive festive celebration. As the Talmud describes it, they would juggle knives and torches. It was a massive party. But you know what happens at parties, right? People have a lot of fun, and it becomes a little bit frivolous and a little bit loose. So what they did was they built something in the temple courtyard. It was a raised platform, and the women were on the raised platform, and the men were in the area down below to separate the women and the men. This is, I see the eye roll, this is the very expressive, even with a mask on. But this becomes the origin of the idea of separation in prayer. And then the question becomes, well, is that necessary? They're at the temple, it's a religious ritual, and they point to this passage which we just read, which speaks of a eulogy going on, and not just any time. It's in the times of the Messiah, when you're expecting, you know, greater righteousness from people, and it's a eulogy, for goodness sake. Like, stay focused, right? And yet, the men here, the women there. The men here, the women there. So that's that's why it's quoted in Sukkah, is because they're having the discussion there about the construction in the temple that was done for this. Now, again, I am not at all getting into this conversation. I'm only explaining why it's there in the Talmud and explaining why you're seeing it emphasized, the men this way, the women that way, and for each of these houses, which are all great houses in Israel at the time, the house of David, the house of Levi, that's the way the eulogy goes. And the eulogy is for Messiah, son of Joseph. That's the idea. The one who was stabbed was the leader of these 10 tribes. There's also reference to it seems, in Malachi, as explained by Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra in source number 9. Malachi is also early Second Temple, but I'm going to skip that in the interest of time. What I wanted to highlight is that the Messiah, son of Joseph concept continues through time. The idea that there is, so to speak, a lesser Messiah who leads the 10 tribes and who is going to lose his life, and then there will be the greater Messiah, son of David, who is going to lead the unified Jewish people. There is a story involving Rabbi Chaim Ibn Attar, who was a Moroccan Kabbalist as well as overall sage. He wrote the commentary on the Chumash, Or HaChaim, that in the 18th century he left Morocco and he went to Israel. The Baal Shem Tov, you know, originator of modern Hasidus in the 18th century, according to the story, told his students one day, the Messiah, son of Joseph, has arrived. And they found out later, he had said this in, you know, Eastern Europe, that was the day when Rabbi Chaim Ibn Attar arrived in Jerusalem. That was the day. He was privy to that information. But in modern times, the idea of the Messiah, son of Joseph, has been invoked to support what I like to think of as interventionist Zionism. Meaning, Zionism has always been a thing for Jews. It's biblical. The idea that we're going to return to Zion is biblical. But what does that look like? Does that mean God is going to bring us back? Which is what it sounds like in Deuteronomy in many passages, right? Is that the idea? Or is it that, no, we return to the land. We take the initiative, we come back to the land, and we build it up. And then that creates, or at least triggers, the period of the Messiah. And the answer is that you have two schools of thought. You have those who are more interventionist and say, no, we're supposed to create it. And you have those who say, no, you have to wait for God to do it. And I'm not getting into the whole back and forth on that right now. It's not not critical for this conversation. But the Messiah, son of Joseph, that concept is invoked to support the interventionist approach. Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer was a rabbi in Poland. He himself, I think, was German. But he was a rabbi in Poland in the 19th century. He believed that we should be restarting the temple and all of the trappings of a Jewish kingdom. He wasn't the only one at his time, but he wrote extensively. And he wrote letters to the great rabbis of the time arguing the legal justification for things like bringing sacrifices when we don't have some of the things that we assume are part of that, like the Para Aduma, the red heifer, which is actually read about in this week's Torah portion outside of the land of Israel, that's read this week. He talked about the legal justification for it, and he said, we are meant to build up the land of Israel before the Messiah, son of David, approaches. That's the Messiah, son of Joseph. Take a look. I brought it for you in source number 10. I translated from his work, Drishat Zion, Seeking Zion. He says, we will first make Judea a harvest for you, preparing for you a settled land. And then the ingathering will be great. He's explaining a prediction from the book of Hosea, the book of Hosea, as I put in the heading there. What Hosea is saying is that that God is going to make Judea a harvest for you, meaning the land will be settled, the ingathering will be great. And afterward, without a doubt, Mashiach ben Yosef will arrive and reign in Jerusalem. And then will arrive Gog, this whole war of Gog and Magog in future times, which I mentioned earlier in the series, via whom the great name of God will be sanctified, God will be one, his name will be one, and then you'll have the ultimate messianic time. But he says the concept of Mashiach ben Yosef is that there is a period in which we are building up the land first before Mashiach ben David. And this idea was invoked most dramatically and most controversially by Rabbi Avram Yitzchak Cook. Anyone here ever hear of the eulogy in Jerusalem? Okay. So the eulogy in Jerusalem was a eulogy that Rabbi Cook delivered, as I put the date in source number 11, on the 20th of Tammuz in the year 5664 is the year. That would make it to the year, someone do the math, 118 years ago. Right, it's actually coming up on the 118th anniversary of it, 1904. It was the day after Theodor Herzl passed away.
After who?
Herzl.
Oh.
You've heard of him. The day after Herzl passed away.
I was thinking about so Herzl when you're talking about this.
He never mentioned Herzl in the eulogy. The eulogy is not, strictly speaking, a eulogy, but it's named for the eulogy in Jerusalem. He's borrowing that phrase, which is a phrase that you saw from Zechariah in source number 8, the bottom of the first page. On that day, the eulogy in Jerusalem, right? So he delivers what he calls the eulogy in Jerusalem the day after Herzl dies. And his message there, I brought you a piece of it that I translated in source number 11. He says, just as God created in a person the body and the soul, and parallel to them, the forces which serve to strengthen the existence of the body in its form, to strengthen and develop it, and the forces which strengthen the spiritual soul and strengthen it. And the height of perfection is to have a strong and properly developed body and a healthy, strong and developed soul, drawing after it with its mighty force all of the strong forces of the body, it should say, my bad, to serve the good and pure mind, the divine will in his world. He says, just like a human being is supposed to develop physically and also spiritually, and the idea is that the body serves the spirit, and when you have everything in its complete form, that's the ideal. So God prepared in Israel specifically these two forces for the Jewish people as a whole. The force which is parallel to the human body, desiring the good of the nation in its position and material strengthening, which is the proper foundation for all the greater and holy traits with which Israel is identified to be a holy nation for Hashem. He doesn't believe in periods. The sentences just go. Hashem, God of Israel, to be one nation in the land, a light for the nations. And the second side, the force of strengthening spirituality itself. He's saying the Jewish people have a physical and a spiritual as well, and where he goes with it, I just got tired of translating, is that the Mashiach ben Yosef is the building up of a physical, and Mashiach ben David is the building up of the spiritual. And what he's doing by delivering the titled eulogy in Jerusalem the day after Herzl dies is he's saying without saying that Herzl is Mashiach ben Yosef. That's the argument, is that which would have been extremely controversial in his day. On two sides. On the secular Zionist side, it will be controversial because they're not interested in this whole doctrine of a Messiah and all this, you know, religious stuff you're putting on Herzl. And on the religious side, who looked at Herzl as somebody who was making the land of Israel a secular place with all these institutions that they didn't want, and you know, don't want you to now co-opt religious imagery and apply it to Herzl. But that's what Rav Kook does. And after him, you find people who did it successively with David Ben-Gurion. They did it with Moshe Dayan, right? They said, well, this is the Messiah, son of Joseph. It's this building up of the land as preparation for the arrival of Mashiach. Yes, Vanessa.
Rabbi, are they both supposed to come at the same time? Are they in tandem?
So the answer is we don't really know. Because all the predictions we've been reading are pretty vague. Even the Zechariah one, which is the most explicit you're going to see in Tanakh, talks about this war on Jerusalem and the one who was stabbed and the eulogy for him, but it doesn't actually say Messiah, son of Joseph. Like, we're combining things in order to arrive at that, but we don't have enough that's explicit. It sounds like it's sort of 1-2, right? The tribes come back, they fight their war, their leader is killed, and then there's this, you know, great big reunion that takes place. Jerusalem is saved. But honestly, it's very hard to know. Yeah, Stephen.
It seems here then that what Rav Kook is saying, that Mashiach ben Yosef is a concept, not a person. It's one person after another. It's this progression in time.
So I think he would say it's a person. And he's saying that it is an individual. That's not him. Rav Kook passed away in 1933. He never had the opportunity. He referred to Herzl, correct. Others after him then applied it in their day to whoever the great leader was who wouldn't fit the Messiah son of David, because Messiah son of David, as we saw earlier in the miniseries, leads the people back to observance of Torah. That's not something that you see in a Ben-Gurion, as an example. But they did see them as leading and building up the land preparatory for a messianic time.
Do we know if Rabbi Kook believed in this as a concept of a state of Israel as a secular nation, or whether he was imagining the other kind of state, the being,
right,
of the return of the Jewish people to Jerusalem, but not necessarily a secular state as well?
So it's a good question. Rabbi Kook was of the belief that, in general, his overall philosophy of the world is that the world is moving towards perfection. And it's a progression. It's not a binary thing where we're in a terrible state and then tomorrow we've hit utopia. There is a progression of the individual. So one of my favorite lines in his Harod HaTshuvah, where he talks about repentance, is he says repentance is guaranteed. It is going to happen. Everybody is going to do it. It's just a matter of how long it's going to take them to get there. He had a very optimistic view of humanity, and he has an optimistic view of the world. And he says that all the steps that we are taking in our day to return to the land, including the secular pioneers, including all of their activities, are to him preparation for and necessary steps to lead to what will ultimately be a Jewish nation governing itself in its land under Torah. So, for example, he has an essay, a short essay, in his book Orot, literally Lights, in which he speaks of the Jews having been exiled from their land at a time when governing a country required such barbarity that it's better not to be able to govern a country at all. That's his statement of why we had to leave the international arena. And that we're coming back now. He's saying this before or during World War I. We're now coming back because we are seeing a growth of civilization, and it's going to be possible to run a country in a humane way. Yeah, we're working on it. Like I said, he's an optimist. But that's his idea. Yeah.
Also, those secular Colossians had very religious backgrounds.
Many of them absolutely did. And also, secular to them doesn't mean what secular means in many other arenas. I mean, the famous example is Ben-Gurion with his love of Tanakh. Yeah.
Well, they still have the Yishkeit and the love of Judaism and the love of being a Jew.
Right, which is what I mean when I say secular meant something different for them.
Not the organized religion part.
So that's where things are very unclear. Look, we have a legend in my family. My great-grandfather lived in Vienna and was active among those early Zionists and in Herzl's circle. And like we can trace that within the family and the organizational involvements. That part is not a legend. That part we know. But the legend goes that Herzl asked my great-grandfather to teach his son to say Kaddish for him. Which is inconsistent with a lot of what we know about Herzl, and that's why I say it's a legend. But what do we really know? You know, what do we really know? We know what history has chosen to preserve, because that's the way history works. I'd like to think it's true, you know. But in terms of this Messiah son of Joseph, it's something people don't really talk about, and I can understand why, because the sources are really unclear. But it's there in the Talmud explicitly. It is read into the verses like what we saw in Zechariah, and it's a very interesting discussion to me of what exactly our ideal is. Is it the interventionist approach that this seems to promote, or is it wait for God to take care of everything?
Is that like a dry run, maybe?
In a sense, maybe. Maybe a dry run. So I want to just see if we can do one more piece here that we discussed last week briefly. We had noted that, and I brought you the passage again in source number 12, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is a Talmudic sage, lives in the middle of the 3rd century Common Era, who is involved in various supernatural things. And in this story, he meets Elijah, because that's sort of de rigueur if you're into supernatural things. He meets Elijah at the entrance to the cave of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, where he had hid from the Romans. He asked Elijah, "When will the Messiah come?" And Elijah says, "Go ask him yourself." "Well, I'd like to. Where is he?" "Oh, he's at the entrance to Rome." And then you see the rest of the passage, which we read last time. And he says, "I'm coming today." "Yeah, today if you fulfill my commandments." Fine. The idea, though, that the Messiah is at the entrance to Rome is fascinating. It ties into source number 13 from the Jerusalem Talmud, which may be well known as well. Certainly people who haven't read this have still heard the idea that the Messiah is born on Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, the date of the destruction of the temple, but not only on that date, but that date in the year the temple was destroyed, which is either the year 68 or the year 70. Take a look from the Jerusalem Talmud. Rabbi Yudin, son of Rabbi Avo, said, "There was a Jew who was plowing one day. His ox lowed before him." The ox kind of does whatever oxen do, makes its noises. "An Arab passerby heard the sound, and he said, 'Jew, Jew, release your ox, release your plow, the temple is destroyed.' It lowed again. And this time the Arab said, 'Jew, Jew, tie your ox, tie your plow, for the King Messiah is born.' And Rabbi Bun said, 'I didn't need this Arab passerby to tell me that the Messiah is born with the destruction. It's a verse in Isaiah. It says, and the Lebanon will fall to the mighty,'" which the Talmud is taking out of context. In context, it's not talking about the fall of the temple. It's actually talking about the Assyrians. Nonetheless, the Lebanon is a reference to the temple built with the cedars of Lebanon. And then what does it say? The next verse says, "A shoot will emerge from the stump of Jesse." Right after the Lebanon falls, a shoot emerges from the stump of Jesse, father of King David. And that's a reference to the Messiah in context in Isaiah chapter 11. That's exactly what it is. It's a reference to the Messiah. So you have this idea that the temple is destroyed, the Messiah is born, which goes along with the idea that the Messiah is sitting at the entrance to Rome, which is the empire that destroyed the second temple. There's even a midrash that says that he's born at the time of the destruction, and then he is spirited away to the Garden of Eden. This midrash is quoted in various sources. I brought you in source number 14. It's quoted by Rabbi Shmuel Edels in his Maharsha commentary to the Talmud, although I haven't been able to find it in a canonized body of midrash myself. So this goes back to what I said in the beginning when I mentioned the question of, is Messiah a regular human being or not? If he's a regular human being, he'd have to be pretty old, right? I mean, it's been a couple of thousand years almost since the destruction of the temple. This would seem to put him in the supernatural camp as opposed to Maimonides in source number 15, who said, no, the Messiah is a normal human being who is the king from the house of David, and if he defeats the nations around him and he builds the temple and he gathers the scattered of Israel, he's the Messiah. There was even the idea, which we saw, I think, last time, that King Chizkiyahu could have been called the Messiah if he had succeeded in his reign. But this midrash about the Messiah being at the entrance to Rome has two key problems. Number one, he's really, really old, unless you're going to take the supernatural approach. Number two, that midrash that I mentioned in source number 14 said he's at the Garden of Eden. So is he at Rome or is he at the Garden of Eden? Maybe there is a restaurant called the Garden of Eden now at the entrance of Rome. I don't know. So two approaches to this. One is the literalist approach, which says he is in the Garden of Eden, like the Midrash that I brought you in source number 14. And he is either, when it says that he is at the gates of Rome, the Garden of Eden has different entrances, and it's a supernatural place. It's not down here as a physical location. And one of the entrances is opposite the gates of Rome. That's Rashi's explanation. Another explanation is, this is a fun one, when the passage says in 12 that he's at the entrance to Rome, it actually says Sha'ar de Roma. That's the term. That's the Aramaic. Sha'ar, gate, de Roma, of Rome. However, if you want to say south in Hebrew, how do you say it? Darom, right? Negev also, but Darom. So Sha'ar Daroma could be Sha'ar Daroma, the south gate of the Garden of Eden. That's another explanation that that is offered to resolve this all on a literal level. He's in the Garden of Eden, he's not at Rome, and we're fine. However, Rabbi Moses ben Nachman, also known as Ramban, also known as Nachmanides, was forced to debate with Pablo Christiani, a Jew who had converted to Christianity in the year 1263 before King James of Aragon. And he was asked, as all the Jewish debaters were back in the day, about various midrashim which the Christians said predicted their Savior. And they asked him about this. The Messiah is at the gates of Rome. Well, obviously, that's testament to the Catholic Church, which is the Roman Catholic Church. That was what they said to him. And they forced him to answer them. And he said, I don't want to answer you. He didn't want to deal with this. But his answer to them is what I brought you here in source number 16. I translated a piece of it. And this is from his record of the disputation. He got in a lot of trouble. They kicked him out of Spain because he published his account of the disputation. They didn't like that. He said, we have sages who have written that the Messiah will not be born until close to the time of the end. By the way, I know it's 1101. We're going to finish with this. Don't worry. When he comes to take us from the exile. He says, I have traditions that the Messiah isn't born until the time of the Messiah. He's not sitting here for 2,000 years waiting. Therefore, I do not believe this text statement that he was born on the day of the destruction. He says, it's not literal. It's meant to teach you lessons, right? You can learn about hope arising from despair. You can learn about the potential for redemption coming in at the time of greatest devastation. It doesn't, you can learn that the Messiah is going to come and destroy Rome in the Messianic age. There are all sorts of lessons that you can draw from this. You do not need to take it as a literal statement that he's at the gates of Rome. And that was the approach that he used in that disputation. There was always much discussion as to whether he meant what he said in the disputation, or he was just saying what he had to say to defeat the Christian arguments, because losing the debate meant all the Jews would have to convert or leave. So there are high stakes there, and he may say things he doesn't actually believe in order to win. But he won the debate, for the record. But the Jews were allowed to stay in Aragon, and again, he could have stayed until he published his account, and then they forced him out, and then he made Aliyah. He moved to Israel, so what could be bad? But those are the two things that I wanted to at least get to. I had a couple other things that I wanted to get to. God willing, next week we will reconvene. I want to talk about signs of the arrival of the Messiah, the idea that Israel will bear fruit when the Messiah is coming back. I want to go back to that source that we saw about the, you know, the generation that's all good, generation that's all bad. I want to talk about some of the calculations that we ran through last time. So please be back here next week. Thank you so much for being here in person.